Good day. Today is Monday, 20th July 2026, and before I proceed with this programme, let me remind you to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. Now, in this programme, I shall be focusing mostly on the situation in Ukraine and in the conflict there, though I will also be saying some things about the situation in the Middle East, and I will also say very brief things at the end of the programme about the arrival on the political scene of the new British Prime Minister, Andy Burnham. But let's first of all turn to the situation in Ukraine, because one gets the sense, at least I get the sense, that this strange period of false artificial euphoria that held the West and Ukraine itself in its grip over the last few months has now abated, with the situation on the front lines in the Ukrainian battlefields and also in the sky having turned decisively against Ukraine, and with the economic news in the West getting darker, even as the Russian economy, contrary to all the speculations, continues to be mostly stable. Now, let's first of all turn to what's been happening in the conflict in Ukraine. Well, yesterday we continued the relentless Russian hammering of Odessa and of the city, of the ports around Odessa. The Russians are now attacking bulk carriers. These are ships. They're attacking the ports of Odessa. They're attacking the road and railway systems leading into Odessa. They are talking quite openly about the fact that they're attacking Ukraine's logistics and railway hubs in western Ukraine, but specifically in Odessa. I get the increasing sense that the Russians are working to isolate Odessa itself from the rest of Ukraine, making it difficult to move supplies or men into Odessa in the event that there is an attack on the city, even as they impose what is now unquestionably a total embargo, a total blockade of the Ukrainian coast. It is, as far as I can tell, now all but impossible for ships either to sail to or from Ukraine using Ukrainian ports. The Russians crossed another threshold when they attacked and appear to have at least severely damaged and perhaps even partially destroyed a Turkish-owned ship in the harbours of Odessa. This is something which I think the Russians have wanted to avoid doing up to now, but they have done it. And, well, the hammering of Odessa continues. And I notice that despite it, President Erdogan of Turkey, who so vigorously objected back in 2022 to Russian attempts or alleged Russian attempts to blockade Odessa, this time is remaining completely quiet. Quite why that should be so, incidentally, is an interesting question. I would have thought that Erdogan would be noisy in his complaints and protests about this. Maybe it is because the Russians have slightly dialed down exports of natural gas to Turkey, though I doubt that that is the reason. Or it could be that Erdogan is worried about the situation in the Middle East and in the Persian Gulf and doesn't feel that this is a good moment to quarrel with his erstwhile Russian friends. His ally, his close ally, Aliyev, the president of Azerbaijan, as I touched on yesterday, is busy trying to repair relations with the Russians. And Azerbaijan's foreign minister has been in Moscow, where he's had meetings with Lavrov. And over the course of those meetings, and over the as a result of various statements that Aliyev himself has made, we have been told, though I don't think anybody truly believes, that Russian-Azerbaijanian relations have been completely repaired again. But anyway, the Russians have been hitting Odessa. They've also continued to conduct strikes on Kiev itself and on Zaporozhye and on other places. Not as massive as the strike on Kiev that I discussed yesterday. And of course, the key point about all of these strikes, the ones on Odessa and those that are taking place elsewhere across Ukraine, is that the Ukrainians, now to all intents and purposes, have no functioning air defense system anymore. They're not really able to shoot down ballistic missiles. It's debatable whether the Patriot missiles ever were able to defeat the ballistic missiles, but they certainly can't now because there aren't any of them any longer in the possession of Ukraine. So the Russians are able to launch strikes on Ukrainian cities anywhere in Ukraine and do so with virtual impunity. There is no air defense system that the Ukrainians can deploy in order to deter these attacks. And, well, we have heard more reports about the immense damage done to Kiev by the massive Russian strike on Kiev that took place a few days ago, 2 days ago. And, well, the reports about the ceiling of a Ukrainian subway station, a Kiev subway station, having in places fallen in, apparently those reports have now been confirmed. Zelensky has again begged for air defense missiles. He said that the Ukrainians are having problems clearing up, as he put it. The problem is that there are no air defense systems available to provide to him. The United States is once again heavily committed to a conflict with Iran. There's been an article in, from memory, the Washington Post, where a US military official, a Pentagon official, told the Washington Post that the United States would not be able to sustain its current campaign against Iran for very long because of the shortages, the critical shortages in precision-guided weapons, both offensive weapons, missiles, and defensive weapons, air defense missiles. And this military official speculated that the White House either didn't know this, which I find impossible to believe, or didn't fully understand it, which I suspect is very, very likely. But anyway, whatever. Given the shortage of American weapon systems, air defense systems, and the urgent need for them in the Persian Gulf and in the Middle East, what realistic option is there to provide air defense missiles now to Ukraine? The latest word from the Middle East is that the Iranians have been attacking US air bases across the Persian Gulf. The result was that the United States pulled back many of its personnel and its air assets to bases in Jordan. Those bases remain within the range of Iranian missiles and drones. So the United States has had to pull back, apparently, increasingly from its bases in Jordan as well, all the way back to Israel, to be precise. The trouble with that is that, of course, locating your air assets in Israel, quite apart from the fact that it increases the distance until you reach territory from which you can launch missiles at Iran, quite apart from that obvious strategic problem, if you have air bases in Israel, if you're using air bases in Israel, you need to protect those air bases. It is even more politically important that you do so if you are the United States than it was to protect your air bases in Kuwait, Qatar, the UAE, Saudi Arabia, and Jordan. So the United States does not have air defense missiles at the moment that he can share with the Ukrainians. And some weeks ago, Zelensky was begging the Europeans to provide him with all the air defense missiles that they had left. And that number of air defense missiles now is relatively short. And the Europeans, of course, know that for the moment, the Americans need all the air defense missiles that they can produce and would not be in a position to replace any air defense missiles that the Europeans provide to Ukraine. So the Europeans have held back from supplying air defense missiles to Ukraine. They are not heeding Zelensky's pleas. So, for the moment at least, Ukraine is open territory for the Russians. They can attack anywhere they want, in whatever force they want, from the sky, and there is really nothing to prevent them doing so. Even the Geran drones, which Ukraine could shoot down previously, it is going to find increasingly difficult to shoot down as these drones become increasingly perfected and advanced as they move at ever higher speeds and at ever higher altitudes and conduct deep, almost vertical dives to hit their targets. It's going to become increasingly difficult for Ukraine to attack even Geran drones, let alone Russian ballistic and hypersonic missiles. Now, that contrasts with what Ukraine is doing, because of course Ukraine continues its drone offensive to the extent that it can against Russia. And last night it again launched hundreds of drones, somewhere in the region of 400 drones towards Moscow. And again, as has been the consistent pattern over the last month and a half, the drones were unable to penetrate into the center of Moscow, if that was the objective. None of the big aeroplane drones, the Ukrainian aeroplane drones or other types of drones, were able to attack targets in central Moscow, and nor were they able to attack targets that make up Moscow's gigantic military industries or attack the various important design, military design centers that are based in Moscow. And for the record, refinery attacks over the last 2 or 3 days seem to have dwindled significantly. Perhaps they continue to take place and I'm missing the reports of them, or maybe They are taking place, but on a smaller scale. But, well, whatever. I haven't actually heard reports of Ukrainian drone attacks, successful drone attacks on Russian refineries for, I think it's about 3 days now. I'm not saying that there's been no attacks on refineries during that time, but, well, for whatever reason, I haven't heard about it. Now, the Ukrainians have attacked oil facilities. They attacked, as I discussed in my program yesterday, some type of oil storage facility in a place called Noginsk, which is in the Moscow region. I'm not sure what this facility was. Pictures appeared of a fire at this facility, but the fire seemed to me to be relatively small. So we're not talking about massive damage. But then perhaps it's worth saying that my sense was the satellite pictures, which perhaps are wrong. I'm not good at reading and understanding satellite pictures, is that this Noginsk facility was not particularly big to start with. So anyway, I mean, there was an attack on this facility in Noginsk. From what I could tell, it was an oil storage facility more than a refining facility. Perhaps it was a place where petrol, gasoline is stored. Just saying, I'm not sure. And last night, the Ukrainians did attack another similar facility in the Moscow region, and a column of smoke appeared over that facility as well, suggesting that some damage was done and that a drone did get through. Again, my impression from the video footage is that the smoke column did not point to an enormous fire. And again, for the record, I understand that this was not a refinery. I'm not sure what it was, but again, it was some kind of oil or maybe gasoline storage or diesel storage facility. I'm not going to speculate. Anyway, the Ukrainians also, however, attacked more warehouses. Now, I am not sure that these warehouses belong to Wildberries, the Russian Amazon equivalent, or its rival, Ozon. I'm not sure how to pronounce the word. But I strongly suspect that they did, in which case it again reinforces my opinion that Ukraine is now attacking civilian facilities that form part of the civilian logistic chains, part of the e-commerce logistic chains in Russia, as opposed to strictly military facilities. And well, I strongly suspect that this is the case, and that points to Ukraine's fundamental problem, because as it cannot continue with its drone offensive, apparently against hard targets, refineries, military logistics centers, military industrial centers, design offices where Russian weapons are designed and eventually produced. Ukraine is trying, or so it seems to me, to cause inconvenience to public life, to civilian life in Ukraine, in Russia rather, by disrupting Russia's massive and extremely smooth functioning e-commerce industry. And well, this may have an effect. I mean, destroying warehouses of this kind where goods are stored could very well cause delays in supplying goods to customers in Moscow and the Moscow region, and maybe elsewhere in Russia too. And that will cause disappointment and anger, and some of it will be directed at the Russian government. But it is not going to affect the course of the war. And Ukrainian military officers, soldiers, have been saying this very thing now increasingly in the Ukrainian media and in Ukrainian social media, that the much vaunted, much talked about drone offensive has not improved for them their increasingly difficult, indeed disastrous situation on the front lines. And in fact, all that these drone attacks do is provide rationalizations that the Russians can use to conduct their own far more powerful, far more deadly strikes against Ukraine, against Odessa, against Kiev, against other cities, Zaporozhye, Dnipro, or wherever. And well, that is what I'm sure we're going to see play out over the next few days and weeks. And all of this, even as the Russian military offensive in Ukraine continues. Now, I ought to say, before I finish discussing the Ukrainian drone offensive, that just as I haven't heard about Ukrainian drone attacks on refineries for some days, I also seem to be seeing a dwindling in reports of attacks on Russian shipping in the Sea of Azov and in the Black Sea. Whether this is because of the increase in Russian air defense, or because ships have been told to keep away from areas of conflict like the Sea of Azov, or whether some of the momentum, the political momentum behind the drone offensive has been lost following the sacking of the Ukrainian Defense Minister, Mykhailo Fyodorov, who was the driving force behind this drone offensive. Which of these it is, of course, I don't know. I suspect it is a combination of the three, but I also suspect that of those three, the most important probably is that the Russians are sorting out their air defense. Now, there is a specific reason why I think this, and that is that Putin now has come out and has spoken about this whole issue. He's had a discussion with the acting governor of Zaporozhye region, Yevgeny Belitsky, and they've discussed the situation and the situation with drones. And Belitsky reported to Putin that the situation with drones is being brought under control. He said that overall the situation is stabilizing and that the Novorossiya highway is now adequately protected, and the situation overall, as I said, is gradually stabilizing. So, well, we will see whether that remains the case. But I suspect that the Russians are indeed in the business of sorting out their drone defense operations, just as they allegedly have done in Zaporozhye region. And Well, we will see what happens. Whether the Ukrainians will continue this drone offensive now that its architect, Mykhailo Fyodorov, at least at the moment, appears to have gone. Now that brings me back to the situation in Kiev, because yesterday Zelensky began his long round of meetings with Ukrainian military officers, senior military officers, and military commanders. And there's been much speculation that this is all intended to lead up eventually to the dismissal of the overall military chief of Ukraine, Alexander Sirsky. But those who were expecting that this might happen yesterday were disappointed because though Zelensky's consultations with various military officers are continuing, no announcement about Sirsky's fate has been made so far. What we are hearing is that Zelensky has made a major effort to persuade Mykhailo Fyodorov, the sacked defense minister, to rejoin his team. Not, however, importantly, as defense minister, but as a member of Ukraine's National Defense and Security Council. It seems that Zelensky and Fyodorov were talking to each other extensively throughout the weekend. Zelensky offered a very wide remit to Fyodorov to supervise weapons development and weapons deployment and reform of the armed forces as a member of the National Defense and Security Council. But Fyodorov apparently consistently refused to take up the job, insisting that he was either be reappointed to the defense ministry as defense minister, or he would not play any part in the government at all. It was either the defense ministry or nothing. And it's understandable why Fyodorov would do this, because even though the National Defense and Security Council is indeed an important body in Ukraine, the Secretary of the National Defense and Security Council is slated to be Klimenko, the man who Zelensky intended to make defense minister in Fyodorov's place, but whom he didn't in the end make defense minister because of opposition in the Ukrainian parliament from MPs of Zelensky's own party. And what Fyodorov no doubt understands is that if he accepted a post on Ukraine's National Defense and Security Council, he would find himself subordinate to the man who had been intended to replace him, who was, of course, who is, of course, Klimenko, who would undoubtedly act, no doubt, on Zelensky's instructions to clip Fyodorov's wings. Most likely, if Fyodorov accepted the post, he would be a member of Ukraine's National Defense and Security Council for 2 or 3 months. Then, when the furore over his dismissal from the defense ministry had completely settled down, and when the SBU had completed preparing its case against Fyodorov with the various corruption allegations, Fyodorov would again have been quietly sacked. There would have been no further protests, and Fyodorov would have been once and forever exposed to criminal proceedings brought against him by Zelensky's allies within the SBU. So Fyodorov, very understandably, rejected this proposal, has rejected this proposal, and the considerable resisted the considerable pressure from Zelensky to reconsider his stance. So anyway, the political crisis in Kiev continues. The meetings with the military people that Zelensky is undertaking continue. Protests continue in Kiev and in other Ukrainian cities, but some are saying that the numbers of people turning up at these protests is now starting to decline. I'm not there. I cannot say this for a fact. I think the fundamental problem that Fyodorov and his backers in Ukraine face is that the military, the uniformed military in this quarrel, back Sirski. Sirski himself may not be popular. He may indeed be seen by many Ukrainian soldiers as a ruthless, hard-driving officer willing to throw away their lives to little actual purpose. There are references to the fact that he's referred to within the Ukrainian military as the butcher. So Sirski may not be popular, but his criticism of Fyodorov and Fyodorov's drone offensive, that it is mostly presentation, it is mostly imagery, and that as such, it is a major diversion of increasingly scarce resources from the battlefronts to the media, to a media operation. I suspect that sticks, that line sticks, and is supported by many of the soldiers. And the fact that Sirski was not sacked yesterday, despite rumours that he might be, and despite the fact that Zelensky has been talking to the military officials, that suggests that at this particular moment in time, military officers are not prepared to break with Sirski because they don't really want to see Fyodorov back. So that is my guess about this political crisis. I said when I discussed it about 2 days ago that I did not think it would lead to a crisis within the government, that it would result in the fall of Zelensky or anything of that kind. I said that I thought that the government, that Zelensky would see it off, and it seems to me that that is exactly what is happening. And with Fyodorov gone, probably some of the momentum behind the drone offensive is now going away, which is maybe why we're seeing fewer reports of attacks on refineries, fewer reports of attacks on ships in the Black Sea. Someone has concluded that these attacks ultimately have proved counterproductive. The attacks on the Russian grain ships have, the only result they've achieved has been to provoke far more devastating attacks by the Russians against Odessa, leading to a blockade of Ukraine's Black Sea coast. And I think that as a result, support for Fyodorov is possibly ebbing away. The only thing I would say is that Kiev politically is an incredibly extraordinarily complex place. There are many different factions there. There are doubtless factions within the Ukrainian government and even within Zelensky's entourage. So far, Western governments have not come out and spoken out in support of Fyodorov. But if one of the factions in Kiev decides that this is a good moment to do that, or if a major European government starts to press Zelensky to restore Fyodorov to his post as defense minister, then of course, from one moment to the next, everything might change. But for the moment, I think that Zelensky and Syrsky, in sacking Fyodorov, have won this battle, have won this domestic internal battle. None of this is helping Ukraine on the battlefronts. And I'm going to hear say a little bit more about the situation on the battlefronts than I've done recently in various programs. So let's start from the south, let's start from Zaporozhye region. Starting in late February, in the weeks following the fall of Gulyapolye, the Ukrainians have attempted a series of counter-offensives in Zaporozhye. These mainly instigated apparently by Syrsky himself, but probably the major concern that Syrsky and Zelensky had was that the Russians were getting altogether too close to the city of Zaporozhye and were getting too close to encircling Orekhov, the only important remaining town in Zaporozhye region, other than Zaporozhye city itself, which the Russians don't control. And in order to prevent the catastrophic outcome of the Russians reaching Zaporozhye city itself, various counterattacks were needed. The problem is that in Zaporozhye region, the Ukrainians face two different, very powerful Russian groups of forces. One is group of forces east, I believe, which has been pushing forward from Gulyapolye, which is the force that captured Gulyapolye, and which has been pushing towards Orekhov from the east. The other is group of forces Dnieper, commanded by General Teplinsky, mostly a paratroop, made up to a great extent of paratroop units, Teplinsky being himself the commander of Russia's paratroop forces. Anyway, they've been pushing north from the south, northwards along the east bank of the Dnieper River towards Zaporozhye city, and they've also been probing westwards, oh sorry, eastwards towards Orekhov as well. So that between these two groups of forces, Orekhov has been caught in a vise. Well, the result is that the Ukrainians, with inadequate forces to defeat both groups of forces at the same time, have been caught in the situation of sometimes when the Russian army from the east is advancing to Orekhov dangerously, sometimes having to defend and counterattack them. But that leaves open the Russians advancing on Orekhov from the west. It gives them opportunities to advance further. So then the Ukrainians have to pull their forces back from the east, back towards the west, to try to slow the Russian advance from the west. And it's been going like this. It's been a sort of seesaw between these two Russian forces for the Ukrainians since the late winter. And every time it happens, the Ukrainians recapture some ground, but then, of course, they have to redeploy to stop the other Russian advance, and the Russians take ground back and then take some more. And in fact, we can see that steadily the vice on Orekhov is indeed tightening. And according to Ukrainian reports, the problem with these counterattacks intended to slow the Russians is that even when they do slow the Russians for a few weeks, the price comes in very heavy Ukrainian losses. So there doesn't seem to be much that the Ukrainians can do there. Meanwhile, Teplinsky's group of forces, Dnieper, is also located on the east bank of the Dnieper, opposite the city of Kherson, which of course the Russians controlled for much of 2022. Anyway, according to Ukrainian reports, the Ukrainians have been obliged to expand the evacuation zone on the west bank of the Dnieper, which suggests that Russian artillery along the Dnieper is becoming increasingly active and that the Russians are now increasingly heavily shelling Kherson city and its environs. Anyway, we will see what comes of this. Now, further north, the situation for the Ukrainians goes from being difficult, as it is in Zaporozhye, to being critical. In Dobropilye area of western Donbass, near the town of Dobropilye, which lies to the west of the Slavyansk, Kramatorsk, conurbation, one gets the sense of a gradual collapse of Ukrainian front lines. The Russians supposedly, well, according to the Russian commander-in-chief, General Gerasimov, are in the process of capturing a string of important villages immediately to the south of Dobropilye. The Ukrainian garrison in Belitska is said to be essentially surrounded. And, well, it looks as if the battle for Dobropilye is going to begin fairly soon, with the Russians also having reached the outskirts of Dobropilye from the east. If the Ukrainians lose Dobropilye, it is extremely bad news for them. It effectively seals the cauldron around the Slavyansk, Kramatorsk conurbation. And it also opens the way for further Russian advances west and north. As none other than Putin himself said, there are no fortifications to speak of west or north of Dobropilye to which the Ukrainians could fall back to. So that is happening there. In Konstantinivka, we've had some truly farcical events, tragic and farcical events play out. The Russians captured Konstantinivka about 2 weeks ago. In my opinion, they've been in effective control of Konstantinivka for much longer. The Ukrainians dispute this, and the Western media takes its cue from them. So the Ukrainians want to prove to their friends in the West that Russian claims that they control Konstantinivka are false, just as back in the autumn, with the stunt Zelensky carried out, he was able to persuade his friends in the West that the Ukrainians were still in control of Kupiansk. So, yesterday, I mentioned how the Ukrainians had arranged a stunt, an AI manufactured video showing Ukrainian soldiers raising their flag in the center of Konstantinivka. Then, a few hours later, another video appeared, this time not AI generated, again showing Ukrainian soldiers from the 45th Skala Brigade, very controversial brigade in Ukraine, raising a Ukrainian flag in Konstantinivka and showing photos of Zelensky and Syrsky. And then a few hours later, the same two Ukrainian soldiers who had raised the Ukrainian flag appeared in a video produced by the Russians, the Russian Defense Ministry, this time raising the Russian flag in Konstantinivka. And the Russian Defense Ministry says that the two soldiers were almost immediately captured by the Russians, and the Russian Defense Ministry has interviews with these soldiers, which I am not going to talk about. I strongly disapprove of the practice of captors of soldiers who have been captured arranging interviews with them, public interviews with them. I think this is completely wrong. Both sides in this conflict, by the way, do it. But I'm not going to go along with that practice, which I personally strongly disagree with. Anyway, the fact is that this was another stunt. All it's achieved is to have two more Ukrainian soldiers captured by the Russians and massive embarrassment inflicted upon the Ukrainians. To deepen the level of embarrassment, it appears that the 45th Skala Brigade kept up the original video footage of the Ukrainian soldiers raising the Ukrainian flag for several hours after the Russians produced their own video of the two soldiers raising the Russian flag. Now, Konstantinivka is under Russian control. Any attempt to deny this is delusional. That's what I would say. It is an act of denial. It is a big place. Konstantinivka is a big place. Perhaps Ukrainian soldiers can infiltrate into it. But if they start filming themselves raising flags, and if these videos are then released in real time, all they're doing is they're giving away their positions to the Russians, who of course at that point immediately arrest them. So this is a foolish and pointless thing for the Ukrainians to do. Anyway, elsewhere, it seems that there is now heavy fighting going on as the Russians attempt to crush, to occupy the salient that the Ukrainians still hold between Konstantinivka and Chasiv Yar. Again, I would have expected the Ukrainians to withdraw from this area. I'm puzzled that they have not done so. It seems to me that any Ukrainian troops still there are certain to be surrounded, and it's going to be another pointless sacrifice of brave men. And elsewhere, further to the north, a whole cluster of Russian forces now appear to be converging on the Slavyansk thermal power plant and on the village of Nikolaevka. The forces that are being deployed against these two places are huge. And though the defences are strong, it's impossible that the Ukrainians will be able to defend there for very long. And further north, we still await the announcement from the Defence Ministry about the fall of Lyman. And perhaps most ominous for the Ukrainians of all, it seems that the Russians are now indeed advancing westwards from Kupiansk towards a water reservoir. This is, of course, in Kharkiv region. The Russians are also in the process of clearing the village of Belikolodyas. My guess is that they now control most of this village. The whole of northeastern Kharkiv region looks like it's soon going to fall to the Russians. In which case, the encirclement of Kharkiv will have begun, just as a little further westwards, the encirclement of Sumy, the city of Sumy, is also gradually taking place. And, well, I understand that there's the first chatter inside Ukraine about how these Russian advances in northeast Ukraine seem to be preparing the way for a future Russian advance towards Kiev. Specifically, it seems that to the northwest of Sumy, there is one small town. I don't remember its name. But if it is captured by the Russians, the road to Kiev lies fully open and the distance is not so great and there are no great fortified barriers before the fortifications of Kiev itself are reached. Now, there's been a lot of speculation in the Russian side of the internet about the potential return of General Surovikin, General Armageddon, as some people call him. And a lot of it links him, or purports to link him, to a Russian advance towards Odessa. I think that the Russian forces in southern Ukraine already have strong commanders, and I am not sure that this is in fact where Surovikin, assuming he returns, would be sent. If you want a decisive, tough commander, which is what Surovikin is reputed to be, and if you want somebody who carries about him the air of authority, which for whatever reason Surovikin undoubtedly does have, and you want also someone who is said to be a specialist in capturing cities, well, which Surovikin reputedly also is. He was apparently central to the capture of Severodonetsk and Lysychansk and a Solidar and Bakhmut. Well, wouldn't you send this supposedly highly effective commander to deal with the most important target of all, the most important objective of all, which is the city of Kiev? Just saying. In which case, especially if the forces that are said to be gathering in Bryansk for the advance into Chernigov are activated, I, for one, can quite easily see General Surovikin appearing there and leading his forces towards Kiev. Now, this is, of course, to be clear, speculation entirely on my part. It's just that it's the way that I know, what I think I know about how the Russians would work. We'll just have to wait and see. Certainly, if these various Russian armies in Kharkiv, Sumy, and perhaps Chernigov region coalesce together and start moving towards Kiev itself, then the entire character of the war will change dramatically, especially if by that point Donbass has fallen and the Russians are at the gates of Zaporozhye and on the eastern banks of the Dnieper. So anyway, I've gone into some detail about the state of the war. It's important to say, however, that diplomacy as such is essentially at a stop. It seems that about, well, a few weeks ago, there was some sort of bungled diplomatic initiative put together by certain European governments. I'm not completely sure which ones, but I believe it was the governments of Britain, France and Germany, but it could also have been the governments of Germany, France and Italy. I'm not sure. Anyway, it seems that their ambassadors asked to be received at the Russian Foreign Ministry and that they attempted to begin some kind of dialogue with the Russians there. The problem is, as with all European envoys who have been sent to or tried to conduct missions with the Russians over the past year, starting with Macron's envoys who went to Moscow in February, and of course we've had various telephone calls from various Western officials, and President Costa of the European Council also attempted some kind of outreach to the Russians. These ambassadors came and made the same demands and made the same statements as always. They again, in effect, demanded a ceasefire on the existing conflict lines. They were again unwilling to entertain any of the long-standing Russian demands. And the Russian Foreign Ministry, I don't know whether Lavrov himself was personally involved, basically told them, you've come empty-handed, there's nothing new here, please go away. So, another so-called diplomatic initiative came to nothing. This, even as one senses that the doubts are now growing in Europe again. There was a very plaintive article yesterday in the Financial Times about how the 21st sanctions package put together by the European Union, the European Commission, faced concerted opposition, not from several countries within the European Union. The ones who have attracted the most attention have been the Greeks, who objected to the prohibition on EU ships, EU-owned ships carrying Russian LNG, even when it was being supplied to third parties. The Greeks said that this would inflict catastrophic damage on the Greek shipping industry. Other countries apparently also insisted on carve-outs to protect their own interests. The Bulgarians appeared to be hostile to the whole idea of a further 21st sanctions package, and said that they could see no point in further sanctions on the Russians unless these could be shown to do more harm to the Russians than they were doing to the Europeans. And anyway, the result was that the entire meeting to agree the 21st sanctions package ended in complete disarray. A few months ago, there was a lot of rejoicing in Europe amongst all the usual people when the Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban lost the general election, the parliamentary election in Hungary, and was replaced by Peter Mawar, the new pro-EU Prime Minister. And I read all sorts of commentaries at that time about how the major roadblock against further EU sanctions on Russia, with the removal of Orban, had been removed. In fact, as things have turned out, and as Orban himself repeatedly said, the reality was that he was never the main roadblock against further EU sanctions. Rather, what used to happen was that countries that were quietly, deeply sceptical of the sanctions would hide behind Orban and hide behind his opposition to the sanctions, until the point came when Orban himself would have to back down and agree to the sanctions, but with some cosmetic concession to Orban himself, at which point all of the other countries that had been quietly telling Orban, "We're right behind you, but we don't want to come out and speak with you," they would at that point have no choice but to go along with the surrender that Orban had made. Now that Orban is gone, these countries have no one to hide behind. So they've come into the open about their opposition to various sanctions proposals. And with Orban also gone, it means that there is no single person who the European Union can intimidate and bully to get him to capitulate and agree to the sanctions, ensuring the compliance of all the rest. So Orban's removal has not made it easier to impose sanctions. On the contrary, for the moment, it is making it more difficult. And the Financial Times is starting to talk about a crumbling sanctions regime, that the doubts about the sanctions are increasing across Europe, and there is increasing skepticism about whether the sanctions can be even maintained at the current level, not least of all whether they can continue to be increased. The Financial Times talks about peak sanctions having been reached. Actually, by any objective measure, peak sanctions was reached in February 2022 with the freezing of the Russian central bank's assets and the expulsion of Russia from SWIFT. Everything since then has been, well, of limited value, can I just say? But the Europeans have not wanted to face up to this at the moment. Now they are collectively having to face up to the reality that further sanctions inflict more pain on them than they inflict upon the Russians. And, well, my friend, my good friend Ian Proud has written a superb article on his Substack site, The Peacemonger, in which he goes into this in detail. And he goes through the whole economic history of Russia since the 2014 crisis. He shows how, in the first 2 years after sanctions were imposed between 2014 and 2016, Russia did indeed experience certain economic difficulties, which I well remember, by the way, and how the first year of the sanctions, of the current iteration of the sanctions in 2022, also resulted in a contraction in the Russian economy. The problems, however, were never great enough to force the Russian government to change course. Since then, Russia has successfully adapted to the sanctions. And not only has it adapted to the sanctions, but it has been forced to adapt in ways that have led to a restructuring of the economy, which paradoxically has improved living standards and increased the rate of economic growth. This is a complex topic, and it's one that I hope to discuss with Ian in a dedicated program, which I hope we will do together on the Duran. And anyway, we will get into this in more detail eventually. But the point is that those critics of the sanctions policy in Europe who are skeptical about sanctions are right to be. And, well, we had a blundering and unintended admission of the effect of the sanctions on Germany from none other than the German Chancellor, Friedrich Merz. He blurted out during an interview that one of the reasons why German industry has become uncompetitive is because it is no longer receiving Russian gas. It's an interesting admission because it proves that Merz knows this fact very well. In Britain, as I may as well now say, we have a new Prime Minister, Andy Burnham. Starmer quit this morning, and Burnham finally took over to complete lack of interest and enthusiasm from the wider British population. He's doing so at a time when the British government is involved in an argument with China over the nationalisation of British Steel, Britain's main steel company. British Steel, which used to be publicly owned, was privatised many decades ago. It started to lose money. It was then bought by a Chinese industrial conglomerate. They did invest a certain amount of money in it and sought to modernise its production. But they couldn't turn it round, and it remained loss-making. and the Chinese company eventually began to look for a seller. What then happened was the British government came along and simply nationalized the company without giving the Chinese compensation, which has infuriated China and provoked a stinging rebuke from the Commerce Ministry in Beijing. But what nobody's saying is that, of course, what the British state has nationalized is a company, British Steel, which continues to be loss-making and loss-making in a big way. And the reason British Steel is loss-making is because of the high energy costs in Britain. Steel production is one of the most energy-intensive industries around. If the cost of your energy in Britain is four times greater than it is in the United States, and twice greater than it is in France, then it is going to be impossible to produce steel at a competitive price in Britain, whilst simultaneously paying British workers European wages. So, of course, British Steel is loss-making. The same is going to be true of industry after industry across Britain, as it is true in Germany, and as it is also true elsewhere in Europe, including, by the way, just to say, in France. And gas prices, wholesale prices for gas in Europe are now rising again, and they will continue to rise because the amount of gas in the reserves, as I've said many times in many programs, is running very low for this time of year. And of course, with the conflict in the Middle East, oil prices are rising again. Just before I started this program, they'd hit $91 a barrel, so they're heading back towards $100 a barrel again. And well, this is obviously the worst and most foolish time to be piling on further sanctions against the world's fourth biggest economy, which also happens to be, in aggregate, if you take the totality of all forms of energy, still the world's biggest energy producer. When they will learn this in Brussels, well, of course, I can answer that question. They will never learn this in Brussels, and we will continue, therefore, to have the situation continue to get worse and worse and worse. But anyway, we do now have at least opposition within the European Council to more sanctions, though no doubt Ursula will use her tools, she's described them, to try to get her will on sanctions enforced once more. And even as that is going on, even as all efforts by the Europeans to start proper diplomacy with the Russians continues to fail, we get more reports about a back channel between German business and Russian business, and about a further meeting between businessmen from Germany and Russia at the Four Seasons Hotel in Baku, in Azerbaijan. Notice this happening at exactly the moment when the foreign minister of Azerbaijan is talking to Lavrov, who obviously must have known about this meeting. And well, again, this doesn't look to me like a serious effort to try to bring some kind of end to the Ukraine war. And certainly it does not suggest to me any plan to begin a real rollback of sanctions or a restoration of economic ties. But the fact that these meetings are taking place once again shows how concerned people in the business world in Europe are about these things. Now, one of the businessmen on the Russian side who attended this meeting was a man called Zubkov, who used to be, incidentally, a fairly senior official in the Soviet Communist Party. He's an elderly man now. And then for a time he worked in Putin's government. And for a year he was Prime Minister of Russia. He then became, and still is, Chairman of Gazprom. He, of course, is not CEO of Gazprom. The chairman of Gazprom is not exactly an honorary post, but it is a less important one. But anyway, the fact that he participated in this meeting is not, I think, a sign that Gazprom is intent to cut deals with the Europeans. It is that Putin, who is aware of these meetings, decided to send a man who is known to be extremely loyal to himself, who is Zubkov, to go to this meeting to keep an eye on what was taking place there. What I have heard is that the Kremlin is as skeptical of these meetings as European governments are, and has warned Russian business people who participate in these meetings to make no long-term commitments to the European businessmen that they meet. But anyway, the meeting did take place, and we will see what comes. So, in the meantime, the war goes on. Ukraine being hammered every day, the Russians pushing forward every day, a political crisis in Kiev that remains, for the most part, unresolved, and a European Union that seems to be drifting aimlessly, unable to reverse policies that it has failed, that have failed, but unable also to move forward with more aggressive actions like further sanctions, because it knows that European countries are becoming skeptical. And probably some of this skepticism on the part of some European countries gains support from growing skepticism in the White House, apparently, about Lindsey Graham's bone-crushing sanctions bill. The latest word in Washington is that Trump is becoming more skeptical about the bill because he worries that if it's ever enacted into law, the Russians will be able to continue to sell oil, but that they will do so outside the dollar system, and that this will further undermine the international position of the dollar. I think that is an entirely valid concern, by the way. I think that is exactly what will happen. I think the trade in Russian oil will not go underground exactly, but it will happen outside the dollar system. But I'm sure also that President Trump, who must be aware now that this conflict with Iran that he finds himself in is becoming open-ended, does not want to see more oil taken out of the global energy system. And what he intends to do in the Persian Gulf, whether the speculations about capturing islands are true, but we'll just have to wait and see. Whatever it is that he intends to do for the moment, I think he probably understands that if the kind of sanctions bill that Lindsey Graham and Richard Blumenthal co-authored ever came into law, we could indeed be looking at $200 oil, and we would also probably see Chinese retaliation against the United States in the form of a stopping of exports of rare earths. So anyway, there it is. To repeat again, there are diplomatic avenues which, in theory, might still be taken to resolve this crisis in Ukraine. But the Europeans show no ability to move forward with them. The Russians have come to the view that the Europeans are irredeemably hostile. And after the debacle of Anchorage, the Russians no longer trust the Americans. And Lavrov, in the comments I discussed in one of my recent programs, has made that completely clear. Everything points to a military outcome in the conflict, to the fall of Donbass, to the fall of Orekhov, to further Russian advances, perhaps a Russian advance towards Zaporozhye city this year, perhaps a Russian advance towards Kharkiv city this year, two of Ukraine's biggest cities, just saying. And ultimately, future Russian advances towards Odessa and increasingly, it looks like, Kiev itself. I can't imagine a more disastrous outcome for the West, never mind Ukraine, than this, but I think it is the one we're going to see. Anyway, this is where I finish my program today. Let me remind you, you can find all our programs on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble, X, and Substack. You can support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar and by going to our shop. Links under this video. Last but not least, if you've liked this program, please remember to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.